Guards, Ethan. Guards, escorts, call it what you will. One thing is for sure, said Ethan. If the Besquith said jump, everybody in here would ask, how high?
To one side of the entry door, there was a small booth, with a very bored-looking Ziwi slumped over the counter.
Drop your jackets in here. We don't want all that crap from outside being dragged everywhere. It will only give me more work to do when we close up. And I have enough to do tidying up after those mutts.
The Ziwi inclined its head toward the howling Besquith, and its pink nose twitched in apparent disgust.
Sure thing, said Ethan,
unsealing his jacket and letting it slip off his shoulders to reveal the PS6 pistol hanging at his waist. The Ziwi's black-on-black eyes went wide at the sight of the weapon, and, if anything, got wider as Gregor Jackson's jacket opened to reveal another of the deadly people stoppers. Ethan gave the rodent his most reassuring smile.
Company policy, I'm afraid. Quote, all personnel engaged in prospecting operations on behalf of the Eli Corporation must be armed while visiting an unfamiliar planet, moon, or orbiting station. Unquote.
Ethan moved closer to the diminutive Ziwi, taking a quick glance about before whispering conspiratorially to him.
I reckon it's because they could not get insurance for us if we were not armed. Then anything that goes wrong is all our fault, leaving the corporation off the hook and indemnity free.
Reassured by Ethan's explanation, the Ziwi took the opportunity to engage in some corporation bashing.
I know exactly what you mean, friend. I was employed in the Red Diamond Mine on Cathal. A supervisor I was, until the owners just closed the whole damn thing down. They left a shitload of us without cash to pay for a ticket out of here. So here I am, saving every last credit I can to buy my way off this rock.
Damn, man,
said Ethan sympathetically, immediately recognizing a potential source of intelligence that only needed a friendly shoulder to cry on.
A friend of mine had that happen to him when some Kachkala aligned with a Wathayat dumped his sorry ass out in the Centaur region. Tell you what, why don't we get ourselves a drink and you can tell me all about it?
The Ziwi looked at Ethan uncertainly, until Ethan produced his yak.
Hell, I'll even buy the first round or two.
Now you're talking, grinned the Ziwi.
Alistair tapped Ethan on the shoulder to get his attention.
We're going to find a seat, Ethan.
Sure, sure. I'll be over in a minute,
Ethan said dismissively, while whispering something to the Ziwi that made the little rodent squeak with laughter. Leaving Ethan to interrogate the talkative employee, Alistair and Gregor made their way across to the main bar area, dodging the occasional worse-for-wear patron as they did. Reaching the bar, they found that their Veach bartender was about as interested in his job as the Ziwi, and, although he had undoubtedly seen them, he ignored their presence while he continued a conversation with a Bakulu, who was holding a drink and two of its tentacles, and employing a third to emphasize what must have been an enthralling story.
"Service is pretty poor around here," commented Alistair,
to which Gregor decided to take matters into his own hands, reaching over the countertop and retrieving a pair of none-too-clean glasses, placing one in front of Alistair and the other on the counter in front of himself. With still no reaction from the Veach, Gregor's hands disappeared over the top of the counter once more, only to reappear holding a half-filled bottle of a brownish liquid. Unsealing the cork, Gregor held it under his nose and gave the contents a sniff, regretting the action instantly as a powerful odor cleared his sinuses and threatened to burn the back of his throat clean out.
"You might not want to try that again, son. It's likely to leave you looking for a new pair of lungs,"
came a deep, booming voice, with an accent that neither Scorpion had heard in what felt like a lifetime. The Scottish brogue cut clear through the background music, even managing to overwhelm the yapping of the Besquith. Alistair's head spun in the direction of the voice, and his eyes went wide as they fell upon something behind the bar which, if you were only to see the head, you would happily have taken for a human male, even with the obvious prosthetic eye, which burned like a laser out of the darkness of its socket. It felt like Alistair had lost control of his own eyes, as they moved down the man's neck, onto a torso partially covered in loose-fitting clothing. Where there should have been flesh and blood, skin and bones, there was instead metal alloy joined haphazardly to the original flesh. Arms, bare from the elbow down, showed signs of being supplemented under the skin by artificial aids.
"Aye, as you can see, laddie, there's not much left of the man I used to be, and over the years I've made do with what's at hand to keep me alive."
A low, rumbling laugh, a mixture of sadness and melancholy, filled the air.
"Not many decent cybernetic surgeons out this far."
Alistair shook himself, dragging his gaze back to the man's face. The one still human bright blue eye stared back at him, assessing him.
"Alistair Sinclair," he said by way of introduction, nodding toward Gregor. "And this is Gregor Jackson. Arrived in the system a couple of hours ago. Doing some preliminary work to see if it's worth our boss's time and money investing in an F-11 extraction and purification refinery operation here."
The man's eye maintained its steady gaze for a few seconds more, before it blinked, and the man thrust out a gloved hand.
"You can call me Orin."
The name was pronounced with the rolling R's of the Scottish Highlands, so it came out more like Orin. Alistair gripped Orin's hand firmly, feeling the distinctive, unnatural outline of metal beneath the cloth.
"Prospectors, you say?"
Orin pointed toward Gregor's sidearm.
"Packing a bit heavy for that, are you not?"
"Company policy," interjected Gregor, preparing to go through Ethan Kroll's explanation from earlier, only for a sardonic expression from Orin to stop him in his tracks.
"Of course it is, laddie. Of course it is."
Orin reached under the bar and produced a bottle of clear liquid and slammed it down in front of Gregor.
"Now stop your jabbering and drink some of that while I speak to your boss, will you?"
Suitably rebuked, Gregor unstopped the bottle and poured himself a generous helping of the lighter brown liquid, sniffing tentatively before taking a sip. Fire burned its way from his lips, across his tongue, down his throat, and slammed into his belly. Orin let out another of his deep laughs as Gregor coughed hard enough that it felt as if his lungs were about to come out of his mouth.
"Have ye not had decent whiskey before? I make that one myself, and it's only about 110 proof. Not even enough to put hairs on your chest, man."
Ignoring the still spluttering Gregor, Orin returned his attention to Alistair.
"And I take it that fella gossiping like an old fisherman's wife to yon wee Zeewee o' mine is wi' ye too."
Alistair looked across to where Ethan Kroll was engaged in deep conversation with the Zeewee that had relieved them of their jackets when they had first come in.
"That would be correct, Orin. Ethan Kroll, my chemical engineering expert."
"Inquisitive lot, aren't you?"
Alistair shrugged, while keeping his face expressionless.
"My bosses like us that way."
"I'm sure they do, Alistair. Though you might want to be a wee bit careful around some of my more
Orin cast his eye toward the yapping and howling Besquith.
Aggressive patrons.
Yeah, I saw them when we came in, said Alastair in a low voice. Surprised to see mercs around here. I thought the Red Diamond mine was closed.
That it is, Alastair. That it is.
Orin waved one artificial hand in a wide sweeping motion.
But as you can see, I'm busier than ever.
Alastair decided to press his line of questioning.
And why would that be, Orin?
Let somebody take over the mine. Orin let out his now familiar deep bass laugh.
You could say that, laddie. Would you be spending the night?
Alastair was momentarily taken aback by Orin's sudden change of direction, but recovered quickly.
We'd planned to return to our ship tonight. She's carrying out a geographical survey of Moon 14 to see if it could sustain our refinery.
In fact, the Glambring was hiding a lot closer, just a hop, skip, and a jump by stellar standards, in orbit around the neighboring moon, Moon 4.
14 would be all the way around the far side of the gas giant at this time of year. It would take hours in yon wee dropship of yours.
It never occurred to Alastair to wonder how Orin was aware of their method of arrival. He was too busy wondering why the Scotsman would suggest they spend the night. Well, there was only one way to find out.
I think that's a great idea, Orin. It'll give me a chance to pick your brains about what support facilities we can expect to get from this town.
Orin reached over and gave Alastair's shoulder a friendly slap.
Oh, sure we can jabber on over a drink after we close up and...
Throwing a look at the mixed crowd in the bar.
After this lot, head back to their rooms.
A Besquith banged his glass on the bar, halfway between Orin and the beach bartender, who was busily serving his friend the Bakulu.
Duty calls, said Orin,
heading down the bar.
Gregor,
Alastair said, beckoning the man over. Gregor looked happy to place his drink down, even though he had been nursing his second glass for the entire duration of Alastair and Orin's conversation.
Head back to the dropship, and tell the pilots we are going to overnight here. Grab our go-bags, and bring them back here.
Understood, Colonel.
The words were out before his brain realized he had said them. Both men looked around furtively to see if they had been overheard, and Alastair's eyes locked on one single bright blue eye staring straight at him. Orin gave Alastair a curt nod before returning to serving the Besquith. Had the man overheard Gregor's slip of the tongue? Surely the background noise had covered his mistake. Still, Orin's single eye seemed to have a playful glint to it. Alastair decided that it was something to worry about later, as he reached for the bottle sitting beside Gregor's abandoned glass. Pouring himself a shot, he threw it back. The fiery liquid was certainly a kicker. Perhaps he should order something less potent. Catching the eye of the beach, he ordered a Crassian beer and settled back to await Gregor's return.
Chapter 14. Nothing to do but wait. The Glambring's gym was deserted late at night, which was why Tim liked working out then. Alone with his thoughts, he had time to think without being interrupted by the endless platitudes dictated by Mary Protocol if other Scorpion troopers or members of the Glambring's crew were about. It also allowed him to listen to his somewhat quirky taste in music without having it funneled directly into his brain via his pinplants. There was just something to be said for listening to 20th-century heavy metal music through thrumming speakers, the sound waves bouncing off your skin and making the thin hairs on your arms stand on end. Angus Young's guitar solo from AC/DC's 1981 hit, Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap, was in full swing, and Tim's running legs pounded on the running machine's rotating belt as he increased his pace to match the beat of the song. Through his panting, he struggled to get the words of the song out. The AC/DC song was the unofficial anthem of the Scorpions, and Tim had not met a trooper yet who could not repeat the entire song from memory. In Scorpion lore, the song had been a favorite of Duncan Sinclair, founder of the Scorpions, who had played it incessantly during the PT sessions of the original Sinclair Scorpions recruits, as he said it got their blood up. Well, it was sure as hell working with Tim, as his feet pounded remorselessly on the moving belt of the machine, while he tried without success to put thoughts of Alistair, Ethan Kroll, and Gregor Jackson out of his head. The communication they had received via the pilots of the dropship while the Glambring lurked in low orbit of the airless Moon 4 had simply stated that the group had made contact with a person of interest and would be spending the night on planet to follow up. Having nothing more to go on, Tim had decided to err on the side of caution and have a quick reaction force of 10 Casper-equipped troopers on 5 minutes' notice to move for the duration of the colonel's stay on planet. Effectively, this meant that either Lieutenant Carolyn Verley's 3rd or Lieutenant Gonzalez Rivero's support platoon were living in the 2nd dropship for 8-hour shifts, ready at a moment's notice to head in and extract the colonel and his companions if they found themselves in a shooting match. In the middle of the song's finale, it died suddenly, and Tim's head jerked around to see who had had the audacity to interrupt him, only for the sudden change of balance to cause him to misstep, flinging him bodily from the machine to crash into an unflattering heap on the gym's floor.
"You do know that it is highly recommended that you allow the machine to come to a full stop before you get off it,"
Anna Wong said with a gurgling laugh as she sauntered over to the embarrassed mercenary and offered her hand to help him up. Ignoring her, Tim pulled himself into a sitting position while rubbing at his elbows and knees, which had bounced off the floor on his way down, trying to ignore the hot flush that was creeping across his cheeks. Since waking from his medically induced coma, while the meds and nanites healed the injuries he had sustained during the firefight with the Javul on Rala Station, Tim had been trying to come to some understanding of his feelings for Anna. Her sudden and unexpected outburst that she was in love with him had floored him. During the intervening 5 days, the two had become near constant companions in their downtime. Tim had even sneaked off early from Casper drills to meet Anna for meals, something which, he had no doubt, Alistair Sinclair and the other Scorpions troopers were politely ignoring. As for Anna, aside from tinkering with the Glambring's propulsion systems and having deep technical discussions with Laris, her Jiha engineer, she had little in the way of work to keep her occupied until the Scorpions were able to secure the as-yet-unidentified new power source, which, if the Flattar information broker Dirol was to be believed, was located on Cathal, barely 300,000 miles distant from where the Glambring hovered in the radar backscatter of the high mountains of Moon 4.
"Now that you have attempted to put me back in sickbay, how can I help you, Dr. Wong?"
Tim said, with as much sarcasm as he could muster while sitting on his rear end.
"Well, Captain Buchanan, since we are being so formal, Laris may have discovered something which could be of assistance getting us onto Cathal unobserved."
"Oh," said Tim.
He still scratched himself occasionally in an automated response to the powdered Canara seeds, which had somehow found their way into his Casper.
"What has that spawn of Loki come up with?"
A faint, pained expression came over Anna's face at Tim's reference to the ancient Norse god of mischief.
"You did throw him in the brig, Tim, after all."
Tim held his hands up in supplication.
Okay, I've already apologized to that little...
The admonishing look on Anna's face prevented Tim from saying what was on the tip of his tongue. Instead, he went with,
"Brilliant engineer, who has no equal anywhere in the entire Union."
Anna's smile was a reward in itself.
"Flattery will get you everywhere, Tim Buchanan," she teased.
"God, I hope so,"
thought Tim, as a smile of his own tugged at his lips, and his eyes ran appreciatively down Anna's lithe body. Catching her still smiling at him as if she could read his mind, Tim decided to get back to business.
"So, are you going to share this great revelation?" he asked.
"Well, Laris had noticed that the Glamberings' reactors had been experiencing some minor, and I mean minuscule, fluctuations, beyond what we could normally see during routine operations,"
explained Anna. Tim could already tell that this was going to go above his head, but decided to let her carry on until he was completely lost.
"Carrying out a diagnostic of the reactor system, he could not discover a cause for these fluctuations, so he widened the scope of his search."
"Yep. Definitely got too much time on his hands," thought Tim.
"And guess what?"
Anna asked excitedly.
"What?"
replied Tim, doing a very poor job of mimicking her excitement, an action which earned him a disapproving look.
"Glamberings is being bombarded by radio waves in the 0.6 to 30 megahertz range," Anna stated.
Tim jumped to his feet, eyebrows drawing together.
"Is it some form of search radar? Have we been detected?" he demanded,
only for Anna to let out a short, snorting laugh.
"No, not at all. It's a completely natural phenomenon. The moon we are using to mask our presence sits within the gas giant's magnetosheath, a part of the magnetosphere. When this region interacts with the solar winds, it causes the magnetosheath to release intense radio waves. Once the moon passes out of this region, the radio waves drop off to a more normal level."
Tim's forehead creased as he tried to see the relevance.
"And how does this help us to get to Cathal undetected?"
"Oh, Tim. Sometimes you military types should pick up a physics book once in a while,"
Anna admonished him.
"Cathal is on the same orbital plane as we are, only a few 100,000 miles behind us. So, in a couple of hours, it will be entering the same region of the magnetosheath that we are in now, and the intense radio waves will..."
Suddenly it clicked with Tim.
"We'll play merry hell with the radar detection systems protecting the facility."
"There you go,"
said Anna, like she was congratulating a kindergarten student who had successfully learned to write his own name.
"Who said all you military types were just muscle-bound knuckle-draggers?"
If he heard Anna's derogatory comment, Tim chose to ignore it.
"How frequently will their radar systems be affected?"
Now it was Anna's turn to wrinkle her brow, as she attempted to recall the figures Laris had come up with.
About 4 hours in every completed orbit."
"I could kiss that little Jiha," cried Tim. "But since he's not here..."
Tim wrapped his arms around Anna and pulled her close, kissing her full red lips with a passion and desire that surprised both of them. Eventually, the need to breathe forced them to separate.
"I need to go speak to Captain Kothu," Tim managed.
Anna's hand went to her throat, stroking it gently, not trusting herself to speak. Tim reached out and touched Anna's cheek softly with his outstretched fingers.
"I'll find you later," he promised,
dropping his hand and heading for the exit. Anna watched him go, her knees loosening and feeling weak. As Tim passed through the door,
Corporal Vega poked his head in. Her ever-present shadow's normally stolid features were split by something she had never seen him do before. Vega smiled and gave her a knowing wink. Anna felt her toes curling in embarrassment.
"Tim Buchanan has a lot to answer for," she thought.
If Alastair Sinclair had any thoughts of an early night, he was sadly mistaken. For the better part of 4 hours, he had sat and nursed one drink after another, doing his best not to look too much out of place while the mixed gathering of alien races surrounding him had gone from slightly inebriated to roaring drunk. Eventually, though, even the Besquith had their fill, and their leaders rounded up their charges and hustled them out the door of the Red Fox. Orin locked the inner door with an audible sigh as he made his way over to where Alastair was perched on a stool, which best suited his human frame. Ethan Kroll and Gregor were seated in a booth, showing an inordinate amount of interest in a slate which was purporting to show the latest test results from their fictional research ship, relayed to them via the dropship, which sat quietly on the landing pad at the edge of the small town. If anyone had been at all interested in what the men were actually viewing and decided to tap into the link from the dropship, they would have found a 3-year-old soccer match between Ethan's and Gregor's favorite teams. As both men already knew the result, a win for Ethan's team, it was hardly surprising that Gregor's face reflected his despondent mood, while Ethan's had a distinctly devilish look.
"Yon man of yours, Ethan, seems awfully happy about your geological results, Alastair,"
commented Orin, as he sat heavily on the stool beside Alastair. The metal gave a loud squeal in protest. Alastair spared a glance for Ethan and Gregor before returning his attention to Orin.
"What can I say? He's a man happy with his work."
Orin fixed Alastair with that single, piercing blue eye.
"And what line of work did you say you were in again, Colonel?"
Alastair felt his muscles go rigid as his posture stiffened. Damn. Orin had somehow overheard Gregor's slip, even in a crowded bar. By way of explanation, Orin tapped his prosthetic eye.
"Micro-laser ranging. Picked up the young lad's voice waves, striking the glass in his hand, and read the vibrations. Kind of like you would use a laser mic to listen into a conversation in a room by bouncing it off the glass window. Over the years, I've kind of got into the habit of listening to my various guests, especially those,"
Orin indicated Alastair's holstered sidearm,
"with shiny new PS6 pistols, and who carry them like they know how to use them."
Alastair raised his glass to Orin in mock salute to the man's deductive process.
"Guilty as charged, Orin."
The bar owner sat back with a misshapen, incomplete, smug look on his face as the human side tried to grin, while the plastic-slash-metal side did a very poor imitation, resembling more a glower than a grin. Tipping a shot from the still half-full bottle into his glass, Alastair said,
"How about we make a deal? I'll tell you why I'm really here, if you tell me how a Scotsman ended up on the other side of the galaxy with a body that looked like it had been put back together by someone with spares he had lying around."
If Alastair had been intending on getting a rise out of Orin, he was mistaken, for the man let out one of his signature deep basso laughs.
"Laddie! I have been on this moon since before your daddy's daddy was a glint in his daddy's eye. So don't think you can pull one over on me."
Orin lifted his own glass with his human hand and downed it in one easy motion, reaching for the bottle to refill it. Eyeing Alastair's still full glass, He gave Alistair a chagrined look.
Are you gonna drink that, or hug it like an old woman, lad?
Resigning himself to having to drink the fiery liquid, Alistair gave a small prayer of thanks to the man who invented the nanites which flowed through his bloodstream and would remove the alcohol before it left him prostrate on the bar floor. Emptying the glass, he slammed it on the bar and let out a loud gasp. The nanites might stop him getting falling down drunk, but they could not stop him feeling the initial effects, and this whiskey felt like paint stripper on the way down his throat. Oren immediately refilled the glass again.
"Well, Alistair, I'm all ears," said Oren.
"How much do you know about what's going on at home?" asked Alistair.
Oren's human eye closed as if he was struggling to remember something. His voice was flat and wistful.
"I've not been home in a long, long time, Alistair. And, as you have probably gathered, and we don't have Galnatut here, so we're more reliant on gossip than actual news."
It dawned on Alistair that Oren might not know about Peepo and the Mercenary Guild's invasion of Earth, nor the fact the four horsemen and the other human mercs had been forced to flee.
"You'd better have another drink, Oren, for I have a tale to tell you that might be hard to swallow. My name is Alistair Sinclair, but my real job is colonel of a human merc outfit called Sinclair Scorpions. A little under a month ago, Earth was invaded by the Mercenary Guild under the command of the Vitanho General, Peepo."
By the time Alistair had finished his tale, the remaining half of the whiskey bottle had been consumed, primarily by Oren.
"I never trusted them pesky wee beasts, ye ken. Never trust a man when ye canna see his eyes, my da used to say. And he was right."
Oren emptied his glass and reached behind the bar to retrieve another full bottle of whiskey. Uncorking the bottle, he poured himself a fresh glass and offered to top up Alistair's, an offer Alistair politely refused. It was not that he was feeling the effects of the alcohol. His nanites ensured he remained stone-cold sober. It was just that his throat was feeling the effects, and he would rather maintain the ability to talk.
"So, what are you going to do about it, Alistair? Are the three of ye going to take on the whole Union single-handed?"
Oren leaned in close, and Alistair smelled the whiskey on his breath.
"Or are ye maybe here to steal whatever yon aliens are working on over on Cathal?"
Oren's good eyes scrutinized Alistair's reaction. When he didn't get one, the bar owner changed tact.
"Do you know how I came up with the name of the bar, Alistair?"
he asked. The bar's name, and the fact that a human, never mind a Scotsman, was running it, was a question that Alistair had been curious about all evening. Oren took Alistair's silence as leave to continue.
"You're not the only man who came out to the stars to seek his fortune, Alistair. I may only be half the man I used to be."
Oren tapped his metallic cheek with one prosthetic finger and gave a little sad chuckle.
"But there was a time when I was a young man like you. When the day came that they were looking for men like me to come out here and fight for money, I saw the chance for fame and fortune. As you can see, I ended up with neither."
Alistair had suspected Oren had been a mercenary, and now he had confirmed it. After a moment, Alistair's eyes narrowed in confusion.
"But surely your unit paid compensation for your combat injuries. That's written into a standard contract."
"Aye, it might be now, Alistair, but not when I was a lad. And besides, my unit was wiped out
Nobody got to go home.
Oren's voice trailed off, and his natural eye glinted softly as a tear filled it. Oren's statement only added to Alistair's confusion.
If the unit was wiped out, then how are you here?
My platoon was assaulting an enemy position, and I stepped on a mine.
Oren's gaze was far away as the vivid memories came back to him.
A bright flash and pain. Oh, God, lad, the pain. I passed out. When I came around, it was dark. I thought it was night, but there was nae stars in the sky. I was cold, colder than I've ever been. I could not feel my body or move any part of me. I dinna ken how long I was in the dark. It felt like days, weeks maybe. Never seeing anyone or anything. Just the dark and the nightmares.
Nightmares? Asked Alistair, in morbid fascination of Oren's tale.
Fragments of memory, said Oren. Blurred outlines of beings. Not human. Definitely not human. But something else. I can never see them clearly, as if my mind has drawn a veil over the whole experience.
Oren paused to take a swig of his drink, and smiled a languid smile that never reached his eyes.
Then, one fine day, I woke up here.
Raising his prosthetic arm with its metal hand, flexing the fingers under the glove with a faint whirring noise.
With all my added extras, and not a penny to my name. There were only farmers here at the time, and they appreciated the extra pair of hands.
Oren lifted his flesh and blood arm, and compared it to the prosthetic with a gentle snort of derision.
Well, hand. I helped out, and they fed and clothed me. Over the years, I made a steady living and some good friends. As they aged, I remained the same, unchanging year after year. A passing ship, maybe 50 or so years ago, had a doctor on board. Decent lad for a roguer. Stuck those damn tentacle things of his in my head. He was able to stop the nightmares, but still couldn't explain all the cybernetics work that had been done on me. Said it was unlike anything he had ever encountered. Wished me luck, and off he went.
Unnoticed by Alistair, who had been completely engrossed in Oren's story, Ethan Kroll and Gregor Jackson had halted the pretense of examining their slate, and were also listening. Avidly.
When the Red Diamond Mine opened,
Oren's head cocked to one side as he accessed his memories.
Oh, it's 20-odd years ago. Yon miners needed somewhere to get away from being underground all the time. The mining company came here, looking for a place where the miners could walk under open skies and breathe fresh air. I seen a wee business opportunity, and opened this place to cater to their liquid refreshment needs. It was all gone along great, until they found yon dustman shit, and the mercenary guild turned up with yon wee rat-faced woman, Peepo, and took over. Now, instead of miners, I have to put up with those bloody yappy Besquith and the mix of scientists and engineers that come down here for some R&R. All just so Peepo and her ilk can have some new reactor to power their shiny wee toys.
Alistair's mouth dropped open in surprise, and he snapped it shut with an audible click.
How do you know they are working on an ancient dustman power source, Oren?
The man waved his glass in front of Alastair's eyes.
Them lads come here and drink till they canna stand up, but their mouths keep working just fine. Besides, who are we gonna tell? The only ships that come here now are those contracted to the Merc Guild.
Have you never thought about going home? Asked Alastair. Back to Earth. Scotland.
Och, lad. Everyone I ken has long turned to dust. I was an only child, so no long-lass nephews or nieces are waiting for great, great, great Uncle Orin to come home from his grand adventure among the stars. The only ones I would have called family were my mates and the foxes. That's why I named this place in their honor.
Ethan Kroll was out of his seat and beside Orin in three steps, looking at the drunk man in disbelief.
The foxes? Do you mean Campbell's foxes?
Orin's head was beginning to droop as the copious amounts of whiskey he had consumed finally took effect, and his voice began to slur.
Private Orin Baird, late of 2nd Platoon, Campbell's Foxes. Sole survivor, an oldest man in the galaxy, reporting for duty, Colonel.
Orin passed out, forcing Alastair and Ethan to catch him before he slipped from his chair.
Now what do we do with him?
Asked Ethan.
I can show you his room,
a quiet voice said from behind the partition, which separated the bar from the more private parts of the building. Gregor hopped over the bar counter and pulled the partition across to reveal the Ziwi, who had taken their jackets earlier, and whom Ethan had been pumping for information.
"How much did you hear?"
demanded Alastair gravely.
"Enough,"
replied the Ziwi, holding Alastair's gaze steadily.
"And I'm willing to help you get into the Dustman facility on Cathal."
Alastair and the two other scorpions were equally surprised by the little miner's offer.
"On one condition."
"Go ahead,"
said Alastair warily.
"You get me off this dust bowl and drop me on some civilized world, and..."
The Ziwi nodded to the snoring Orin.
"You take Orin home. He will never tell you, but he misses his own world more than he would ever admit."
The little Ziwi's whiskers twitched.
"At least when he's sober."
"Deal,"
said Alastair. The Ziwi's head bobbed up and down a couple of times, and if Alastair was any judge of alien facial expressions, a wave of relief mingled with gratitude spread across the miner's face.
"Help me get him to bed. Then I'll tell you everything I know about the mine and the Dustman facility."
Alastair hooked his arm under Orin's bulky frame, while Ethan did the same on the other side, heaving the sleeping Scotsman to his feet.
"Just how much does he know about Cathal?"
Alastair asked Ethan under his breath.
"He was the mine supervisor for the area they found the Dustman facility in. And when people's people took over, he ran one of the crews that cleaned the place out and made it habitable before all the scientists and engineers arrived, and he was kicked out. So, pretty much like the back of his hand."
"Okay. We'll head back to the Glambring tomorrow morning and get our heads together and see if we can come up with a plan of attack,"
said Alastair, his head already running through various permutations. The biggest problem he could see was how to get past the radar screen, completely unaware that that particular problem had already been solved.
"As you can see, ladies and gents,"
said Alastair Sinclair to the gathering, which crowded around the small table in the officers' mess of the Glambring late the following morning,
"our new friend,
Alozika Haklevak or Kopalziak,"
piped up the mole-like Ziwi.
"Call him Al," It's a lot easier,
Orin Baird said, loud enough to be heard through the hands, which cradled his head as he tried to ease his pounding headache. The short Ziwi glowered at his human friend, but did not correct him.
Al, continued Alistair, as he used a laser pointer to play over the image, slowly rotating in the tribee hovering above the table.
Fortunately for us, he retained a copy of the mine and the facility's layout. Now, even though we don't have a definitive floor plan, because the facility was not in full use when Al was removed, we can still make educated guesses based on the infrastructure of power and computer conduits, thickness and composition of walls, ceilings, and floors that the labor force put in before the scientists and engineers moved in.
Around the room, sets of eyes from various species soaked up the image. Al stood up and addressed the group.
The original Dustman facility consists of 8 levels descending from the surface of Cathal, spreading out from a central core into 5 distinct corridors. After the final level, the core continues down through the crust until, at around 36 miles in depth, the core crosses from the surface crust and into Moon's mantle. We presume that the Dustman had tapped the magma at that level to power the facility.
Makes sense, agreed Anna Wong. If there is a subsurface magma ocean, it would produce thermal power for millions of years. Knowing the Dustman's excellence in engineering, I'll bet that they also perfected a means of extracting all the ilmenite, uranium, thorium, potassium, and hydrogen they would need to construct the power sources used in the Rachna. Combine that with their ability to extract F-11 from a gas giant right next door, and I can't imagine a better place to mass-produce the Rachna reactor.
Laris grunted loud enough that Anna gave him a slap on the cylindrical segment containing his head.
What I mean, began the Jiha engineer, is that we have no idea if they have managed to reverse-engineer the Dustman reactor designs yet.
They've not only did that, you wee beastie. Yon laddies have a working prototype,
said Orin, raising his head to fix his one eye on the Jiha.
How can you be sure?
Asked Anna. Orin waved a hand dismissively.
I told you before. When they drink, they talk. And I listen.
An uneasy silence settled on the room as they all digested the information.
What's our best way in, Al? Asked Alistair, with a newfound sense of urgency.
The Ziwi ran his eyes over the floating image until he found what he was looking for. Tapping at the slate in front of him, he expanded an area 8 miles to the west of the facility.
I would suggest here, Colonel. When the Red Diamond Mine was operational, we excavated a number of exploration tunnels, hoping to find more deposits. This particular run proved to be dry, but it was extended anyway, to provide an emergency egress in case of a main shaft collapse. If we enter through there, then we can follow the abandoned tunnels right up to where the outer skin of the facility meets the original tunnels.
The Besquith might be a bunch of mangy dogs, but that does not mean that they're stupid, piped in Tim Buchanan. They're bound to have put all kinds of traps and alarms on the approach tunnels.
Nothing my troopers can't bypass, said Gonzalez Rivero, the support platoon commander, confidently.
Alistair appreciated his well-placed confidence.
That leaves the issue of how we get to the insertion point.
Alistair nodded to the Glambrings El Shah commander.
Captain Cthu.
Thank you, Colonel,
the El Shah captain said gracefully.
Using the data Engineer Laris has gathered on the magnetosheath, we've been able to plot a course which will effectively render us invisible to the Besquith's orbital radar.
A tap of his slate replaced the image of the Dustman facility and the intricate complex of mining tunnels surrounding it,
with an equally complex rendering of the orbits of the gas giant's moons and lesser objects. Another tap of the slate, and the projected course of the Glambring was overlaid, tracking from their current position around Moon 4 to the outer edge of the Besquith's much-reduced orbital radar detection zone.
When we reach the outer edge of their reliable radar coverage, we deploy the dropships, which will carry the strike team to the insertion point.
What about the ground-based radar?
Asked Caroline Verley. Cthu tapped again at his slate, and a series of red overlapping circles appeared on the surface of Cathal.
These are my TAC officer's best guess at the effective range of the ground-based radar our electronic warfare systems have identified. As you can see, your insertion point is beyond their range. However, the dropships will fly nap of the Earth, well beyond the predicted detection range, until they reach their destination.
A groan escaped the Scorpion troopers around the table. Nap of the Earth meant flying as close to the ground as you could without crashing into it. The ground effect turbulence meant for a deeply uncomfortable ride for the dropship's occupants. However, a bit of turbulence was much more preferable than being splashed from the sky by a surface-to-air missile. Alistair clapped his hands once loudly to get everybody's attention.
Okay, people. Let's get this show on the road. Final drop checks in 60 minutes.
Excuse me, Colonel,
interrupted Orin. Unused to interruptions, especially by a man suffering a hangover, Alistair bit his tongue.
Yes, Orin.
The Scotsman focused his good eye on the ship's clock displaying Galactic Union time and ran a quick calculation.
If we wait another 8 hours before we launch our operation, I think you can improve your odds of success.
Tim's eyebrow raised incredulously.
Care to explain, Orin?
When Yon Besquith first arrived here, they were keen as mustard. Garrison duty has made them fat and lazy. There shall be only one platoon off duty at any one time. But the last few months, the beasties have been lingering longer and longer. Now they dinna leave Moon 5 till the next R&R platoon arrive at the bar and kick them out.
Alistair clicked his fingers as he understood where Orin was going with this.
And if we wait another 8 hours before launching our attack, half the Besquith will be stranded hours away from the site they are meant to be protecting. Good call, Orin.
Orin's half-human, half-cyborg face gave that odd smile again.
I try my best, Colonel.
Very well, people. Change of plan. Time on target is now 0230 GUT. For now, we have nothing to do but wait. Dismissed.
As the group dispersed, Tim caught Anna's eye and tipped his head in the direction of one corner of the room. Making their way over into the corner, they had a semblance of privacy. But still, Tim kept his voice at a level whisper.
You don't need to come with us, you know.
Anna clasped her hands behind her back and spread her feet shoulder-width apart.
Now you listen to me, Tim Buchanan. I have my part to play on this mission, too, you know. I've come a long way to find these reactors. And you tell me one other person on this ship, no, in this entire solar system, is more qualified to identify, understand, and advise your troopers on what to recover from the facility.
Anna clenched her jaw, daring Tim to argue, but he had to try.
I'm sure Laris is sufficiently up to speed that...
Enough, Tim,
said Anna in a tight voice.
You have your job, and now it's time for me to do mine.
Tim gave her a pained stare. He knew she was right. However, he did not want to put the woman that he had such deep feelings for into the line of fire. Seeing his anguish,
Anna's eyes softened, and she tried to put on a reassuring smile.
Corporal Vega will keep me safe.
Tim glanced over at the imposing trooper hovering near the room's entrance, trying to make his bulky, body-armored frame less conspicuous, to give the couple at least a sense of privacy, while staying within a few steps of his protectee. Tim gave in gracefully, stepped forward, and wrapped his arms around her slim frame.
"Just you be careful, okay?"
"You too, Tim,"
she said, pushing him to arm's length and looking around furtively.
"Any more of this hugging stuff, and your reputation as a heavy taskmaster with ice running through his veins could be in jeopardy."
Tim let out a small laugh as the tenseness of the moment passed.
"Dr. Wong,"
called Laris, as he stuck the tip of his elongated head around the doorframe, spotting the couple in the corner.
"Ah, there you are. Could you help me calibrate the sensor array one last time? Captain Cthu would like it double-checked, since we have a few hours."
"Of course, Laris,"
replied Anna, then rolled her jade-green eyes at Tim.
"Duty calls."
With that, she followed the Jiha engineer out of the room, Corporal Vega a step behind. Tim looked around the empty room. The diagram of the mine and the dustman facility still floated serenely above the briefing table.
"Nothing to do but wait, I suppose,"
he thought. He walked over and closed down the trivy before leaving the room.
"God, I hate waiting,"
thought Kate Priceman, for possibly the thousandth time since the Salamanca had entered the ELO system. After dropping Jamie Sinclair and his company of troopers off at Wayland Station in the Centaur region, Kate had wasted no time in setting off on the next task Alistair Sinclair had given her. Find his eldest son, Charlie, the two platoons of Scorpions under his command, and return them to New Warsaw and the relative safety of the Winged Hussar's home system. As Kate had discovered, finding Charlie was easier said than done. Alistair had supplied Kate with Charlie's travel itinerary, so she knew he and his troopers had been due to transship at Tall Station on their way to Galax. Fortunately for Kate, it looked like Charlie had received his father's cryptic birthday message and understood it for what it was. A message to go dark and avoid all contact while doing his best to return home. And it appeared Charlie was very good at following his father's instructions. It had taken Kate 3 days of bribes and payoffs to the various low lives of Tal Station to discover that Charlie had managed to secure transportation on a Zupardi freighter, the Tlakoz. Said freighter was due to make a cargo run to the ELO system before heading out to the Crapti region, but from the scuttlebutt she had managed to overhear, the Tlakoz had had a little trouble with pirates on its arrival in ELO. Pirates which, supposedly, had gotten their asses kicked by the crew of the freighter, who had not only fended off the pirates' boarding parties, but had then somehow managed to blow the two pirate ships into nothing more than expanding gas and tiny fragments. Kate smelled the hand of Charlie and his scorpions. Immediately on dropping off its cargo, the Tlakoz had ignored the freight waiting for shipment to the Crapti region, and instead passed through the Stargate, and that was where the trail went cold. And now Kate waited, rhythmically tapping her fingers on the armrest of her command chair, to the great annoyance of the other members of the bridge crew.
"Incoming signal from the Stargate, Captain," said Jacobsthal, the Salamanca's communications officer.
"At last," said Kate, as she tried in vain to hide the impatient scowl which formed on her face. "Put him through."
The trivy at the front of the bridge came to life and revealed the red and green striped face of a Sematazoo, its bifurcated trunk swinging lazily from side to side.
"And how may the Cartography Guild be of service to you today, Captain Priceman?"
the gate master asked in a deep, orotund voice.
"I have a somewhat embarrassing request of you,"